I'm Greg Johnson.
I'm John Morgan.
I'm Frody.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Anyway, we are going to talk about some questions that our listeners and readers have dealt with from normies and family members and so forth about white identity politics. But before we get into that today, we are going to, as usual, thank our donors because we are doing a fundraiser. We have now raised $45,995. So I hope somebody immediately is scrolling down to donate $5 so we can get up to a nice round $46,000. Anyway, I want to thank RH for $20, AS for $10, MR for $200, SS for $30.08, DB for $100, RW for $10, MG for $20, CA for $100, ABR for $50, KW for $30, RH for $30 a month, and also FR for $200. So that brings us to 45.995% of the way to our goal. And we're trying to raise $100,000 this year. So we are 45% of the way there. Again, thank you very much for this very generous support. I also would like to announce that we now have credit card processing services again that allow people to make monthly donations and to make purchases and donations from outside the United States. So I want to thank the people who helped get that up and running. And I want to encourage you to take advantage of this and help us out.
One more win for nationalists and a defeat for the people who are trying to shut us down, I guess.
Exactly.
So can I also just remind people that we still have tickets for the upcoming Scanza Forums? So we have one event coming up in October 12th in Copenhagen with Rasmus Paludan, with Greg Johnson, with me, with Mark Collett, with Millennial Woes. We're going to talk about national populism, and we have one event in Oslo, Norway, coming up on the 2nd of November. We're going to talk about human biodiversity and the biological hereditary basis of human nature and human behavior and groups and so on. And we have a very impressive list of speakers there as well. Greg always speaks at the Scanza Forum. I always speak at the Scanza Forum. Kevin MacDonald is going to speak. Edward Dutton and Helmut Nyborg, that is on November 2nd in Oslo. So send me an email if you are interested in how to join us there.
It's going to be a great event. Both events are going to be great events, both in Oslo and in Copenhagen. I hope you'll come out and join us. I'll be there. I'll have some books to sign and sell, and it'll be a great opportunity not just to hear interesting talks by prominent speakers, including people of the stature of Kevin MacDonald and Helmut Nyborg, but also it's an opportunity to meet new people and to network and to socialize. It's really a lot of fun. You know, it's educational, it'll raise your consciousness, but it'll also be a lot of fun. We always have a great time at the Scanza Forum. So let's begin. Recently we did a transcript by Carl Thorburn of an interview that I did back in 2016 or 2017. No, I think it was back in 2018. It wasn't that long ago. It was from a guy who goes by the name of No More Dogma. He has a YouTube channel, or at least did. I don't know if it's still up. And he wanted me to talk about some questions that he gets from normies, people in his family, friends, whatever, who are, you know, entertaining white identity politics and have objections to it. So we did a podcast on that, and we did a transcript of it and put it out in 5 parts, and it proved to be fairly popular. And I thought, you know, I really should keep the promise that I made at the end of that podcast to do something like this again. And I thought we would just make this a topic for a Countercurrents Radio podcast. So I asked people to send in a few questions that they get, and I thought we would just do a roundtable discussion of how we would respond to these particular questions and objections. There's a piece that was run in Esquire recently, and it was attacking the moderate position on white nationalism found in the pages of the New York Times. I know this is kind of ludicrous to talk about it that way, but Esquire thought that the New York Times had a very moderate position on white nationalism, namely that they made a distinction between white nationalists who believe in violence and white nationalists who don't. And the Esquire magazine people said basically that white nationalism has to be defined as an inherently violent ideology. And I think that that's something that we need to have a snappy comeback for. Is white nationalism, is white identity politics an inherently violent ideology? And one of the things we have to take into account is, well, other ideologies as well. You have to have comparative terms. So do you want to begin, John?
Well, I was going to say, so Islam is the religion of peace, yet white nationalism is inherently violent.
That's basically right.
That's an interesting conclusion to come to. I mean, I know it's in vogue now for the mainstream media to claim that there are now more attacks by quote-unquote white nationalists, whatever they decide to call that, in the U.S. these days than there are from Islamists, although I find that highly dubious. I haven't looked into how these statistics are arrived at, but I suspect
The first thing that they do is they start the clock after 9/11. So that conveniently eliminates more than 3,000 casualties and the biggest terrorist event that ever happened on U.S. soil. So if we start the clock after 9/11, that makes it a little easier on them. But then again, they still don't actually manage to document the claim that white nationalists are making more terrorist attacks than Islamists in America.
Nor do they ever explain how they determine who is a white nationalist.
Right.
I very much doubt there are that many self-proclaimed white nationalists doing these things.
Well, there's an article at Countercurrents by Alan Smithy. He's a great film director, very prominent director, as well as a writer for Countercurrents. Anyway, Alan Smithy has a piece where he basically destroys the claim that white nationalists are doing more terrorism in America than Islamists. So that's very useful. There's a piece that was published at American Renaissance in sometime this year, which looks at claims, I think, from the Anti-Defamation League to the same effect, and finds that they really cooked the books there too. That, for instance, they treated family violence incidents in families that were white nationalist as like white nationalist crimes, when obviously white nationalism wasn't the motivating force if all the parties were white nationalists, or, you know, violence within white nationalist groups. They also basically treated things that were clearly not racially motivated but happened to be done by people who were radical rightists as terrorism, basically. It was fraudulent, in other words.
It would be interesting to see statistics, for example, in Sweden, where all crimes committed by a person who voted for the Social Democrats would be considered social democratic crime.
Right. Yes.
Whereas they consider everything done by a person who is a nationalist of some sort as nationalist crime, as sort of a part of a political category of political violence.
Do they talk about Islamist crime or
gypsy
crime?
I would think not. But that's always been on my mind when they talk about how much crime and violence is committed by nationalists.
Right.
Well, if you would take all crime committed by people who vote for the Democratic Party in the United States, for the Democrats, I would assume,
13% of Democratic voters account for 50% of the crimes in America.
Yeah, that's what I would, assume would be the result. So that's the dishonesty of the whole issue and the sort of statistics that you try to give. Yeah. Because, I would assume that most of the criminals would be more left-leaning.
Well, especially in the United States, where blacks, who are 13% of the population, vote about 90%. plus percent for the Democratic Party.
And isn't that why the Democrats are so ardent about being about letting criminals vote, prisoners vote?
Yeah.
Because they know they will get the votes.
Yeah.
It's because they have the criminal voters.
Yeah, exactly. The other way of going about attacking this claim that we're an inherently violent ideology is not statistical, really. It's simply to look at the ideology itself. We recognize that diversity and immigration, race replacement, things like that, are sources of social conflict. And therefore, we believe that if we separate the races, if we decrease diversity, if we decrease immigration and so forth, we're going to decrease causes of violence. So as an ideology, ethno-nationalism removes or reduces one of the major causes of violence, which is diversity. Now, the flip side of that is that multiculturalism, the advocacy of multiculturalism, should be seen as an inherently violent ideology, mm-hmm. because they are creating conditions that we know will lead to a host of social problems, alienation, tension, the breakdown of the public sphere, the breakdown of public spiritedness, all kinds of petty resentments that fester and grow and eventually sometimes burst into violence. Mm-hmm. Diversity is a cause of social decline. Diversity is a cause of violence. Therefore, multiculturalism is an inherently violent ideology. In fact, it's a far more inherently violent ideology than the people who want to fix the problems of multiculturalism. They're causing violence. We want to fix it. And that's, I think, the best answer to that particular argument.
Yeah, I think that my answer, my reply to that suggestion would be that white nationalism is the least violent ideology, because if you would look at, if you would imagine living in the United States in the 50s or throughout Europe before the massive invasion of mass immigration over the last several decades, would you feel more at home and would you feel more safe in those societies? I think the answer would be yes, because there are lots of things that even didn't exist at that time. Gang rape didn't exist before a few decades ago when it came, and it is like an immigrant thing that, right. that people do. It's not a thing that is inherently in European society. It's a thing we imported.
Right.
And also the so-called no-go zones throughout Europe, throughout, you know, the suburbs of Paris or South Sweden or parts of Germany or London and so on,
exactly.
where basically the police won't even go.
Mm-hmm.
Those things wouldn't be a natural thing in a white Europe or a white America.
Yeah, and we can look at history and show that that was indeed the case.
Yeah.
There was a time before gang rape was a problem in Sweden, and it so happens that it was the time before multiculturalism.
Yeah.
When was the first big Swedish gang rape controversy? It was in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that the first one that I can't claim with certainty that this is the first one that ever happened, but the first one that really became a huge news story was one in Rissne. A place called Rissne, and that was in, I would say, maybe 98, something like that. A 15-year-old girl, she was raped by some 9, probably, immigrants. And I don't remember the details. I mean, this is more than 20 years ago. But the thing is that back then, this was such a horrible thing, and it became a huge news story. But nowadays, it's so common. It's just an everyday thing that happens that it isn't really newsworthy anymore in the same way that it was back then. And it's the same thing with these riots in immigrants' areas where they set cars on fire.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be in the news when they started doing that you know. But nowadays, it's not even in the news anymore because it just happens every day. So it isn't a news story anymore.
Right, exactly.
Because that's just the new standard. Just as I think it was the mayor of London, the Muslim mayor of London, Mr. Khan, who said that, you know, terrorist attacks are just to be expected in the new multicultural society.
It's just part of living in a modern city.
Yeah, it's just a part of living in a modern city. It didn't used to be that way.
Right.
There was a time before this was just a part of living in a modern city. So I think that in itself is just proof that white nationalism, that is, the societies that we had before multiculturalism, multiracial big cities, that is a more peaceful society, a society that people can feel more at home in and trust their neighbors, less crime, less alienation. And there's also lots of research, academic research. Robert Putnam, he wrote a very famous paper called E Pluribus Unum. He's a Harvard sociologist. Frank Salter has written extensively about how social trust and social cohesion just disappears basically in these multiracial societies. So there's just endless evidence backing up the fact that a white society, a white nationalist society, a homogeneous society would be more peaceful and more harmonious and better to live in.
Well, right. I would also say if we want to talk about violent ideology, since it's now apparently the ideology of the Republican Party in the United States, what about Zionism? I mean, Zionism as an ideology can only be realized through force and violence. And a lot of the Islamist violence that has affected the West has actually been the result of Zionist violence.
Right, right.
So, but that apparently is now, you know, the one untouchable ideology in the U.S.
Yes. Well, maybe what we should say is that we're no more violent than Zionism. That's tempting, I guess, as a trolling technique, but it does force people to think about that. But honestly, yeah, Zionism was a settler movement. It was a colonial settler kind of movement in a land already populated by a fairly civilized people who had to be displaced. The situation in Europe before multiculturalism, before non-white immigration, was, you know, the Europeans are indigenous to Europe. Europeans are the indigenous people of Europe. And there was not violent to keep borders, but since the borders have been deconstructed, Europe has been awash in violence. It's been awash in settler violence, basically, being imposed by non-white immigrants. This is one of the things that Renaud Camus talks about. He says that we're not experiencing immigration in Europe, we're experiencing colonization. Colonizing settler replacement immigration. These people are not coming to assimilate themselves to France or Sweden. They're coming to implant their own societies in the body of our societies and to eventually replace our societies with their societies.
And also comparing to Zionism, Israel was a state that was founded on huge quantities of terrorism.
Right.
Where terrorists were celebrated and are still celebrated.
Well,
as the
they're national. They terrorists became prime ministers.
Yeah, they're the founding fathers of that country and that state. And I think that I believe in change without terrorism. I think we can change, you know, our societies without that type of violence. Because
well,
I think there's a slow process where we gain intellectual influence and power over our own people. And like you wrote, Greg, in one of your articles, The Slow Cleanse, there is a model for peaceful repatriation and so on that doesn't include violence. So,
right.
So I think that our vision is far more peaceful than what they stood for as an ideology.
Well, they were trying to assert control over a region that they had lost thousands of years before. We're just trying to hold on to what has always been ours.
Well, we have lost
the United
it.
States. I'm talking of Europe.
But we have lost all white countries. We don't have any countries of our own, but I think we can take them back through a march through the institutions, a building up our own mass media infrastructure, social activism.
Yeah, creating a consensus that we need to have our countries back, and then implementing different policies that reverse the trends. I don't see why it should be inconceivable and morally prohibited for any white person to say, you know, they say that we're going to have more Mexicans and Guatemalans next year. I would like to have fewer Mexicans and Guatemalans next year. It's either one or the other. Or you could have parity, right? Why is it only the case? It's only permissible to entertain having more Mexicans and Guatemalans next year in the United States. Why is it not a topic of conversation to say, how many Mexicans or Guatemalans should we have in America? Do we have enough? Do we have too many? One of the things that I like to say to multiculturalists and diversity mongers is, it's basically a Socratic argument. You just say, you know, is it possible for people to be too rich for their own good? Oh, yes, yes. We can think of examples of people who are too rich for their own good, people who in the lottery ruin their lives. Is it possible to be too good looking for your own good? Yeah, I know people who sort of are spoiled and have glided through life because they're just so good looking, right? People are constantly cutting them deals and overlooking their flaws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Name a whole bunch of good things and ask them, is it possible to have too much of this? And they'll say, of course it's possible. What about diversity? Right? Why do they recoil in horror at that? Because diversity is being put across as something holy and absolutely good. Right? You can never have too much diversity. Right? And it just doesn't make logical sense, though, that if you can have too much money, or to be too good looking, or all kinds of positive things can be bad things if you have them in the wrong degree or if you misuse them. But diversity, we can't ever talk about that. And I think that we just have to get people over that, right? We have to say, let's just grant for the sake of argument that Mexicans are good people. Can there be too many Mexicans in our country? Let's just have a conversation. Do we have too many Mexicans?
Well, of course, if we follow the idea that we're a proposition nation, all people are interchangeable. So I think that's the, you know, where that argument ultimately leads for liberals.
Well, but, you know, they think there are too many white people. They think there are too many of us. So, you know, I think that we just have to force them to be real about stuff like that, right? And one of the things that I love about your average liberal is you get them talking about fundamentalist Protestants, and they eye roll, and they just think they're vile, backwards, stupid, embarrassing people. But if you ask them about Muslims, who by every measure are 1,000 times worse than fundamentalist Christians, they want to make excuses for Muslims. It's like, you are afraid that there are too many Southern white people moving into your community, but you're not afraid of too many Muslims moving into your community. I mean, a lot of them engage in that kind of hypocrisy.
Yeah, I'd urge them to put their money where their mouth is and actually move into a neighborhood with, you know, average type Muslims instead of average type white Christians.
Right, exactly. They'll find out there are lots and lots of differences. One of my writers wrote in, I think it was on Facebook or it was on Gab, one of my friends or followers said, white nationalists really only seem to have one role for women, which is to be mothers. And she thinks that there should be more roles, that we should envision more roles for women in white nationalism than simply being mothers. So what do you think about that, Frody?
Well, I think that Wilmot Robertson had a good response to one of those types of suggestions. It wasn't the identical question, but it was a similar question about women and, you know, wanting to hold women down or whatever. And his suggestion was that women should start having babies before they start having a career.
Right.
So yes, we white nationalists tend to have a traditional, what I would call normal, view of what gender roles ought to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that women should want to be mothers and want to have families. And I think that if you start having families at the proper age, which is like around 20, you should start having kids. Then when those kids are old enough to start school, you can start whatever career. You can become a PhD if you like.
Right.
You can enroll in university when you are, if you have a kid when you're 18 or 19 or 20, then that kid will start school when you are, you know, 20, 25, 26, 27. And that gives you plenty of time to start a career or, you know, get a very thorough education.
Right.
And you know, do whatever you want. But it's now we do things in the reverse order.
Right.
Because women first want to have a career, and when they're 40, they want to sort of fertilize one of their frozen eggs.
Right.
And that's probably not the healthiest way to go about it.
Right.
So I think if we have that kind of mentality, that if we start having kids at a proper age for women, then they can actually do things after that. And can be semi-modern about it, yeah, if you like.
The feminist idea is like, why can't women have it all? Well, but the trouble with feminism is that often they don't get it all. They get the career, but they don't get a husband. Why don't they get a husband? Well, because feminism teaches them to prize traits in men that actually repulse them and make them unhappy. And so they don't want to have relationships with feminist-friendly men. That's a very important thing that sabotages the happiness of women. And so they don't find men, and they don't have kids. Or they might find a guy, but then they're 38 years old, and they're desperately trying to have their first kid when, mm-hmm. you know, their fertility is in steep and irreversible decline. So oftentimes by wanting to have it all in the wrong order, they don't get it.
Yeah.
They end up being cat ladies, embittered cat ladies. And we don't want that. We actually want women to have it all, if that's what they want. And the way to have it all is to start out being a wife and mother early on. But because people don't drop dead, you know, at the age of 40 anymore, after bringing 22 children into the world, right? You have to plan ahead and think, well, you know, our lives are going to be longer than they were in the past. And education is a good thing. I mean, the kind of education we get today is pretty terrible. But in principle, being educated is a good thing. Having a career is a good thing, and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, I think it's very, very good to encourage women to start having kids when they're young and they're most fertile and they're stronger and more energetic and more capable of dealing with squalling babies in the middle of the night and stuff like that, too.
And apparently, women today, I mean, I have actually talked to young women today, you know, in their 20s or, you know, 20, 25, whatever, who are not even aware that their bodies won't handle pregnancy and giving birth the same way when they are 40 as when they are 20.
Yeah.
Is even aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. We are bombarded with all this talk about sex education, which usually entails, you know, taking preschoolers and making them roll rainbow-colored condoms on bananas and receive lectures about oral sex and things like that from trannies or drag queens. And yet somehow, with this bombardment of sex education, vast numbers of young women don't realize that their fertility declines steeply when they get to the age of 30.
They don't get the relevant information.
They don't get
the liberal bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I think it's just important to point out that it's not either modern gender benderism or white Sharia,
yeah,
which is sort of just it's not suited for our people anyway.
No.
So I do think that if a woman starts having kids when she's young, when she's supposed to start having kids and she has three or four kids or whatever, she might find out that she doesn't want a career. She maybe wants a part-time job to feel fulfilled or whatever, to get out of the house. But I mean, it's not, I think women should not be sold on this Sex and the City lifestyle for middle-aged women, that is what they should strive for, because I think that ultimately feminism harms women far more than it harms men. So I think it makes women far more miserable. So I do think that if they find some sort of balance there, we don't only see them as, you know, women or as mothers, but I do think they should need to find out that role will make them happy, because I know several women in their late 30s who are sort of desperately want to become mothers, but they find out that, you know, it isn't all fun and games as it was in your 20s, and it becomes difficult and it makes them miserable.
Yeah, it's really a tragic thing. Feminism is cancer, as Milo Yiannopoulos said. The sexual revolution, and feminism is just the female side of the sexual revolution. The sexual revolution has failed to deliver on all of its utopian promises in as catastrophic a way as communism failed to deliver on all of its utopian promises. It is an absolute catastrophe, an absolute human catastrophe. And I don't blame white nationalists for being a little bit baby mad, right? Or emphasizing this over and over again, because we're practically the only people who are saying this. We have the entire rest of the culture, which has people in a headlock from an early age preaching the child-free lifestyle and things like that. And so, yeah, a lot of white nationalists might become one-note bores saying women need to have families and they need to think about doing it sooner. But damn it, they're right.
Oh, yes.
But there is a bigger picture. And I don't just envision in a healthy white society that women are only mothers. Although a lot of them might discover that that's perfectly fulfilling, that they can be cultured people, that they can be involved in volunteer work, they can have a well-rounded life, and they never leave the domestic sphere and enter the job sphere. I think that that's a perfectly possible thing. And in fact, I think if more women try it, they're going to discover that that's what they want. But if they're not cut out for child rearing and just want a job, we should allow outliers like that.
That shouldn't be the norm, though.
It shouldn't be the norm.
And I should emphasize that of all the people that I know, the women who have chosen the housewife lifestyle with having, you know, several kids and doing that type of thing seem to be far happier than the ones who have chosen, you know, a career or and so for their own sake.
There's this horrible propaganda that, you know, housewives or, you know, they don't go to college, or maybe they choose not to go to college, or, you know, they're dumb, barefoot and pregnant, that kind of thing. Well, honestly, I know some of the smartest women I know are housewives, because they knew that would make them perfectly happy.
Yeah.
And they didn't fall for a lot of stupid propaganda.
And we also, the last thing that I want to say about that topic is that a norm isn't for everyone, if you like. I mean, having a norm is the opposite. How should I rephrase that to make sense? The modern society, liberal society today, makes the exceptions into a norm.
Yeah.
That we should adapt all of society after the exceptions.
Right.
Like, the one in like 2 million people who happens to have actual gender dysphoria, those people's difficulties with finding an identity should determine all of society, how all of society talks about, you know, everyday normal things. So the point is that having a norm is, you know, keeping a norm for the average, whatever, but that still leaves room for the exception, that is, in this case, women who might want to have a career and not want to have children or a family or whatever, but we still have to keep that norm. We still have to keep our eyes on that is the norm, and we still accept that, well, there are women who are not cut out for that.
Well, they might be sterile. One thing. Or they might be disagreeable and they can't find a man. Whatever. They might be all elbows and angles, right? And they can't find a man, but they're intelligent and they're capable in other ways, and they end up running businesses or running political parties, whatever. The exception shouldn't become the rule.
Exactly.
But if you have a healthy idea of how traits are distributed on bell curves, and you make your policies based on what's the norm rather than the exception, you can still have a society that allows a place for the people who are outliers. There's no reason not to. And I think a lot of the hysteria about outliers has just been generated by the fact that the exception is now the rule. And that's no way to run a society. Nietzsche talks about this in the Gay Science, actually. He talks about this, how modern liberalism is a totally dysfunctional ideology because basically it wants to make the exception the norm. And he puts it so beautifully.
Well, today also, we're as we're recording this, we're commemorating Leni Riefenstahl's birthday at Countercurrents. I think she's an example of somebody. Did she have children? I actually don't know.
No.
Yeah, I think there's an example of a woman who, you know, certainly fulfilled a great role in excuse me, the nationalist revolution of her time. You know, unfortunately, she wasn't able to continue that. You know, once the Third Reich ended, but she certainly did her part while it was around. But to add to what you were saying before, I mean, I generally agree with everything you're saying, but I also think people who we need to have a society that is conducive to women being mothers. I mean, the social supports aren't there. I mean, Hungary is making some efforts to introduce incentives, the Hungarian government, for women to have more children. It may not be enough, some people say. I'm not sure. It's too soon to say if it's going to be successful or not, but at least they're heading in that direction. We don't have any equivalent of that in the U.S. right now.
Right.
We're in Western Europe. But also culturally, I mean, the fact is, though, I think it's also the fact that a lot of the culture of women not getting married is that they want to party in their teens and their 20s. And the fact is that guys like that just as much. And I know that things like Tinder and these dating apps and so forth are very popular right now. But I think that's a big part of the problem. I think it leads to these very temporary, meaningless relationships that distract people from actual meaningful relationships that can lead to families. I don't see it as a positive thing.
One of the most bleak and black-pilling discoveries I made in recent months was what happens to the women after their Tinder years run out. The next app they get is called Just a Baby, where they're looking for sperm donors because they've given up on finding a man and starting a family, but they want a baby so bad that they're willing to just do individual peer-to-peer sperm donation stuff. And there's an app for that too. So yeah, it's a very, very bleak world.
that's the biggest black pill that you could ever dispense on this podcast.
Yeah. Yes. So there's life after Tinder, ladies. It's called Just a Baby. Maybe you don't want to get on that carousel to begin with, in other words. Now, there's another element of this question, I think, and that's specifically the idea of the proper role of women in the white nationalist movement. And I have a position that I think is fairly nuanced on this. The position that I oppose was announced years ago, I think it was in 2008, by Michael Walker, who is a guy that I agree with on 99.99% of facts and positions. But anyway, he was speaking at American Renaissance, and he gestured grandly, at least that's how I picture it in my memory, and said, "I would like to come back here someday and find every other chair occupied by a woman." And I thought, this is not ballroom dancing. This is politics. That's not a realistic assumption. We shouldn't have an assumption of gender parity built into political activism such that we think there's something really wrong with our political movement if it's not equally male and female. And I do think that that's a mistaken kind of quasi-feminist assumption. I do think that political movements are politics, policy, it's all connected with war. It's all connected with fighting. It's all connected with protecting your people, policing the boundaries of your tribe and so forth, or establishing a homeland and so forth. Those are traditionally male things, and you're going to find that men are more attracted to politics and war and police services and things like that, especially radical politics that entails a certain social costs in current society. So I don't think it's reasonable to expect gender parity in our movement. However, by the same token, I don't think that we should put barriers in the way of women who do want to get involved, getting involved. Because what are you really doing? You're saying to somebody who's showing up at your door, taking certain risks simply by talking to you, saying, I would like to take on the risks and the responsibility of fighting for the future of our race, and I have this amount of money and these skills and this social capital, et cetera, et cetera. And people say, sorry, baby, you know, we don't even need you to make sandwiches, right? I just think that's beyond dumb. That's just laughable. That's a joke. And I think any movement that basically is driving away potential supporters isn't serious. And so I do think that if women come to the movement and want to contribute, yes, there should be a place for them. But we shouldn't expect that it's going to be approaching gender parity. I think that's unreasonable.
Definitely. And we have women are naturally more conservative than men in the way that, just in the sense that they follow the status quo or follow the zeitgeist of the moment or whatever, they are not going to be in the vanguard of a political movement because women are more sensitive to social pressure.
Right.
And that is why we will get an overrepresentation of weirdos in our movements that are the victims of social pressure, because right. We will get the personality type that is less sensitive to social pressure,
right,
which is the spurgy guys, basically, yeah. and people who don't have a whole lot to lose and who don't really care about social pressure. And we will get a bit of, you know, odd people and so on. But that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the movement as such. Yeah, that was a socially savvy thing.
company exclusive.
Yeah. No. So that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the movement or that we're going in the wrong direction because we don't have 50-50 women and so on. Mm-hmm. Because women are generally not that interested in politics either. It's like, yeah. You know, a lot of women follow the tastes of whatever man they happen to be with at the moment.
Now, there is an interesting exception to this tendency, and that is France, mm-hmm. where a significant percentage of National Front voters are women. In fact, a majority of National Front voters are women. And I don't think that simply has to do with the fact that Marine Le Pen has been their candidate and leader for years. I think it might have been the case with Jean-Marie Le Pen as well. And in the earlier 20th century, the people who wanted to prevent women's suffrage in France were the left, because they thought that women were too conservative and would vote the way the priests told them and things like that. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And I do think there's some biological realism there as well. So if you are an outside and radical political movement and the mainstream of society is against you and stigmatizes you, you're going to find fewer women than men who are going to want to get involved. However, once you become mainstream, you're going to find that the people who are going to be most fervent about maintaining your gains are going to be women. For that biological reason that they tend to be more conservative. So once we win, we're going to start getting more women involved. And once we have won, I think women are going to be one of the bulwarks for maintaining our gains. And at that point, I think it's very, very important that we should have organizations that are open to women, but also I think women's only organizations. There's a book that was reviewed at Countercurrents, I believe years ago now, by Amanda Bradley, about women in the nationalist right in America before the Second World War. They very much felt that this was their country. They were America firsters. They were anti-interventionists. And they had enormous organizations that were very, very powerful. And then, like everything, that was all just rolled up and disappeared once World War II started. It was completely suppressed by the American government. But that is an interesting chapter in history. And it's also interesting to look at examples of the role of women in, say, the British fascist movement in the interwar period. And so forth. There were a number of important female figures and also women's groups involved in those movements. So I think looking at history allows us to see that a lot of things were possible. We know they were possible because they were actual. They actually existed. So I do think that that's a good way of just expanding our imagination on this particular issue.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, just because you conclude or you observe rather that there is no biological or realistic or scientific or historical ground for assuming that we will be 50-50, that is no reason to reject the outlier women that will sort of come to our movement. Yeah. Because I've seen several women who have had far more integrity than, you know, men in general, most men, in speaking up for our interests and mm-hmm. so on, and showing great courage and integrity and intelligence and so on. So that doesn't mean we should reject them. It's just that it's silly to expect equal outcome from so different categories of people as men and women. There's no reason to assume that we will reach 50-50.
If human biodiversity is real.
Yeah, which it is.
And that's what we're all premised upon, we're not going to expect that kind of simple parity. But yeah, I think a nuanced view can take that into account and still not put barriers in the way of success. Mm-hmm. And also recognize that as we succeed, we're going to find more women getting involved. And once we succeed, we're going to find that they're going to be one of the more important bulwarks for consolidating and keeping gains that we have. So I think that is that's a pretty well-rounded answer, actually, for that particular question. Let's look at some other questions here.
I'll just mention, I don't remember which one it was because he writes so much for us, but we ran an article recently by Maurice DeCamp where he made the interesting point that he was noticing that women he had known in high school who had belonged to these Christian groups and were very against gay marriage and things like that. Some of these women he still knows today, and because the culture has changed, now they claim that not only are they in favor of things like gay marriage now, but they always have been. They don't remember that there was a time when they weren't. It just shows, you know, they follow whatever is the trend at the time. They think that's what's normal and that's the way things should be.
Right.
So if we change that cultural paradigm, most women will naturally...
They'll go along with it, and they won't feel oppressed by it.
It's natural that we should want a society where we're the majority.
Right.
Where our values prevail. Yeah.
I think that is sort of true of the normie mentality in general, that they are going to go along with the dominant social paradigm, and they're not going to feel oppressed by it.
No.
And that's an important thing. Somebody asked to talk about the racial purity arguments that people put in our mouths, and I'm not exactly sure. I didn't have a chance to get a clarification on that. But you do hear things like, there's never been a pure race or something like that. And I always... I find that to be a kind of irrelevant question. First of all, I think there are pure races. There are populations that are generally not mixed. And the question of how you define, you know, how do you define a white person? Well, do you look at the DNA of a bunch of recognizable white people. Now, if you find that there are certain genes that overlap between recognizable white people and other groups, do you say, well, they're a mixed race? Or do you say, no, these are just ingredients that you find in white people and in non-white people? It's like analyzing beer and analyzing champagne, and you find that there's water in both, right? So do you say that that this beer is tainted with champagne because they both have a common ingredient? There's a kind of question about what the standard is, right? That I think you could really raise. For instance, I think 23andMe defines Ashkenazi Jews as a European group. They simply define them as a European group. If you're 100% Ashkenazi Jewish, you're 100% European. Well, by their standards. But they will say that other people might not be 100% European because they have, say, genes that are shared in common with certain people in the Far East or something like that. I knew a guy, or actually I saw a comment written by a person. I didn't actually know this person, just to be precise. I saw a comment written by a person who said that he did a DNA test and came back having some Polynesian ancestry, which was literally impossible, you know, given his family tree and given likely courses of events. And the question was, how do you define Polynesian? Was there some Polynesian in him, or is there some of us in Polynesians, right? So things like that, I think, first of all, I just don't think that we should worry too much about these tests, because there are certain arbitrary choices that are made as to what is a pure sample. And then if you arbitrarily choose to say that this is a pure sample, then you can say that Ashkenazi Jews are 100% Europeans, but Finns aren't. I'm sorry, there's something very weird about that. I would just toss that out. My view is this. There are different groups, okay, and there are different races. There are different large races, and there are different nations and subgroups within races. And no matter how those groups came about in the distant past, they have an identity today. And they have ethnic genetic interests. They feel comfortable with people like them. They feel a desire to propagate their kind through time, and they therefore need homelands and laws and communities that are capable of doing that, that are conducive to that. And that's all that nationalism means. And that's true of mestizos in Latin America. It's true of white people. And if by some criteria somebody comes out and says there's no pure anything, that doesn't mean, therefore, that we should all just say, screw it, we'll just screw everybody and open the borders, right? That doesn't follow at all. It doesn't follow that, for instance, the Polynesian population, you know, Polynesians are a kind of population that in the distant past were a product of racial mixing between Australoids and Asians, Mongoloid people. And this is also true of people in, say, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, and so forth. The groups look different because they're different mixes and things like that, and they've undergone divergent evolution over time. And New Guinea has all these little valleys and highlands and things like that where populations have been breeding in isolation for thousands of years. So there are lots and lots of little micro races going all the way from Southeast Asia across the Pacific. If you were to say, well, you know, there's no such thing as a pure Hawaiian, so you should just mix with anybody, that doesn't follow at all. Hawaiians might have a distant admixture. They might have arose out of a distant admixture in the past. But that doesn't mean that they're not a people today and that they don't have interests in preserving themselves. So in a way, the purity argument just doesn't matter if you look at it from an ethnic genetic interest, sort of Frank Salter view. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that we should countenance, say, race mixing today. My view, the way I've put it in the past, is I think we should have a complete moratorium on future race mixing and a complete amnesty for past race mixing, especially if it was in the distant past. And it's so distant that you can basically say, this is just an ingredient in who we are. You know, there are people who say, well, white people are a mixed race because we have Neanderthal DNA. It's like, does that make us a mixed race? Or is it simply to say that one of the things about being white is having some Neanderthal in us? I just want to say, okay, if we don't have Neanderthal, we're not white. It's one of our ingredients.
Well, anyone who wants an in-depth answer to this question should come to Oslo, because there I promise to annihilate all such nonsensical arguments against nationalism or the relevance of race. Basically, I'm going to talk about all such typical social construct and vagueness and whatever
right.
type of arguments against the relevance of race.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really get the question here. The question is, so there is no pure race, therefore race is irrelevant.
Right.
Right. So, well, there's one rhetorical answer, mm-hmm. which would be, would you say that to Jews? Would you say that, therefore, the Holocaust is just the random killing of 6 million
people.
Europeans being killed by other Europeans.
Yes, it's just a European. So is it just a random killing of 6 million people? Or is it actually a genocide? Because right. a genocide wouldn't be a thing if
there was no genus.
If there's no genus. Right. Exactly. So that's the first thing. Are you actually being stringent with these things and actually, or are you just saying it against white people? Is it only right. relevant against white people? The other thing about the racial purity argument, which is a nonsensical argument, it's nothing I can take seriously, and it's not usually used in an honest way, is that hybridization is part of the definition of race. So the biological definition of a species, well, there are slightly differing, sort of different versions of a definition of a species. Either it is where, you know, the distinctions that basically individuals from different species either don't get offspring together or they can't get offspring together. So if we just go with the fact that individuals from different species don't have offspring together, the difference between a species and a race then is that between different races, hybridization is possible, mm-hmm. and it sometimes happens.
Right.
Therefore, the races won't by definition be quote-unquote pure, because it is part of the definition of race as opposed to species that hybridization can occur.
Right.
So it's a nonsensical argument.
Right.
It's purely nonsensical.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of definitional. It's like there's no such yeah. thing as a pure race, because a race is a large category that would include many different sub-races with the possibility of blending.
A race, by definition, includes the possibility of blending, of hybridization.
Right. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in a race is hybrid.
No, exactly. It means that the boundaries around a race are porous.
Yeah.
You know? That is what a race is.
Yeah.
You know? And so are many other things in the world that are very relevant to us.
Right.
So, but I'll go in depth and talk about the sort of philosophical implications of all such arguments on a speech I will give in Oslo on the 2nd of November. I'll talk about the suggestion that race is just a social construct. And there I will talk about that argument and many others like it that are often thrown around by people who don't really know what they're talking about.
Right. Well, one last question, and we have many others that we can continue talking about in future podcasts. I think this is actually a good format for podcasts, is just to talk over questions and help refine our talking points. It's an argument clinic kind of thing. The last question I want to toss out is, what's your take on non-white conservatives? And I have a very simple answer to that. It's like, well, they're outliers, and you can't make policy based on exceptions. You have to make it based on averages. Also, I recognize that a lot of the people who come to nationalism are conservative, but we're not conservatives in that ideological sense. And the fact that there are a few black people who believe in terrible ideological hodgepodges like American conservatism, Candace Owens, for instance.
Didn't she inspire someone?
Yeah, she's actually an a muse for mass murder. That's true. Candace Owensism is an inherently violent ideology, but Candace Owens believes in fiscal responsibility and colorblindness and all these conservative things. She believes in capitalism and limited government and all this other stuff. And she wears MAGA hats. And I think recently as a couple weeks ago, she believed in the First and Second Amendments. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything because, first of all, conservatism is just a hodgepodge of mostly bad ideas, which in America are mostly liberal bad ideas. And second, it's just a way that we can be, it's just a way that unthinking, good-hearted conservatives can be bamboozled into this race-neutral ideology, basically, that the things that they value will survive even if race replacement takes place. And that's just not true. Candace Owens freezes thought in the face of racial annihilation. The Republican Party will cease to exist when there are enough of Candace Owens' cousins voting, right? Well, the whole point, I mean, the whole plan about opening the borders to the third world is to create a permanent one-party left-wing state. And the few outlier Candace Owens types won't matter, and they only matter right now as an impediment to clarity about the absolute oncoming demographic replacement of white people and how that's going to obliterate political conservatism.
Well, I wouldn't say they're good. They're just less bad. I mean, the issue isn't white or non-white conservatives. The issue is that conservatism has very little, if anything, to do with our goals.
Yeah.
Although I would mention as a footnote to all of this, of course, that I know that all of us in this discussion know actually of non-whites who have come over to our side. They're not conservatives. They're actually ethnic nationalists. And even though they are not white themselves, they support our cause. And some of them actually do quite a bit of good work for our cause. So I think we should welcome those people.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, of course, when they come to us, they recognize the fact that we want to remain who we are. We want them to remain who they are. But I think if people who are not white want to support us, we should welcome that. We shouldn't drive those people away.
Yeah.
And I think this question is, it betrays, I mean, if it's honestly asked, it betrays a sort of an interesting mental bias, because non-white conservatives, as opposed, I assume, to the sort of limp-dick liberalism that's accepted at university campuses throughout America and the West today. Well, all people from other countries outside of that would be considered to the right of Genghis Khan as compared to whoever is at a white sort of... My point is that this whole white liberalism or this whole sort of liberalism that is acceptable at sort of sociology, you know, departments in Western universities is only a thing in white countries. Mm-hmm. So if you by non-whites mean actually also people who don't live in white countries and pretend to, you know, be part of us, well, they would all be considered, you know, all of Africa. Do you think, do these left-wing people actually believe that everyone in Africa is like Obama? Yeah. I mean, those people are to the right of anything. If you by right mean you know not liberal, they're definitely illiberal.
They all believe in equal rights.
Yeah, yeah.
They just want everyone to be right. The same. And
yeah, that the genius plan. I'm making scare quotes in the air with my fingers. The genius plan of the left is basically that they're going to get women's rights, gay rights, animal rights, you know, vegetarianism and environmentalism and walkable cities and generous welfare states and public health care and all this kind of stuff by filling the country up with Muslims and Mexicans and Africans. And yes, it is true that none of those countries that these people are coming from have anything like these liberal values. But they assume that these people will always take orders from and vote the way that white liberals tell them to vote. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets a little tricky. Because the whole point of having them here is so that we have their numbers. Mm-hmm. We give them the vote. And then they're going to vote the way that a tiny liberal white and Jewish minority tells them to vote. Mm-hmm. That is not smart. That is not very likely. And it's especially not very likely given that the whole premise of welcoming these people in is multiculturalism, which is the opposite of assimilationism. Mm. So the idea is that somehow we're going to import millions of Muslims into Scandinavia, and we're not going to try and get them to adopt Scandinavian values at all, and yet we're still going to maintain the Scandinavian way of life and the welfare state and all these lefty values. It is so transparently insane and absurd, you have to wonder if this was cooked up by people who were simply up to no good and simply wanted to destroy these societies. The thing is, though, that a lot of liberal types fervently believe this. They fervently believe that this genius plan is going to work.
Yeah.
And that this new country they're creating is going to be great. And it's not.
It's they are often shockingly lacking in self-awareness, these liberals. And they are the most chauvinist,
exactly,
racist in the most negative sense of the word, people in the world. Because I remember there's a case in Sweden where two Antifa journalists, I mean, these are really, really communists,
right? You know?
And they went to do some story. I think it was in Ethiopia. Their name was Persson and Shibi. And they basically rented, you know, armed guards, basically a little militia, to take them over the border to Ethiopia and to make this thing. And they were banned from the country, and then they were thrown in jail. And the whole narrative, basically, the between the lines of the whole narrative was basically, you know, how dare these, you know, these apes not obey us with our values? How dare they have other values? How dare they want to, you know, run the country the way they want to do it and not as we say they should,
yes,
be good little sort of Uncle yeah. Tom's or whatever. Yeah. You know, that's what they want. They want them to behave as well-behaved pets.
Yeah.
These black people. And that's where, you know, we part ways with them, that they call us racist, whereas we respect them. Well, you can live however you want to in Ethiopia.
We recognize they have agency.
Yeah. They'll be responsible for how they live in Ethiopia. I'll be responsible for how I live here, and I'll mind my own business. Whereas the leftists think that they are so far above everyone else that they can just, you know, order them around, these black people, because they don't know better.
Right, right. That is fascinating. Yeah, that is so true. There is an incredibly deep chauvinism in the liberal mind. It's so incredibly deep that they feel like they don't even have to try to assimilate people to their views, that they'll magically accept them somehow. Mm. And it's all going to work out beautifully. And it's not going to work. It's not going to end very well. So what is our view on non-white conservatives? Well, this is a very good discussion, actually. Candace Owens, she's just a distraction. She's in the way of getting normie Republicans to appreciate that there is an oncoming train, a tsunami of race replacement coming down, and that their conservative values are not going to exist once race replacement goes far enough. Yes, we do recognize that there are people, outliers in groups. I mean, Candace Owens is probably sincere, although she's certainly making tons of money by being an outlier. She's probably sincere. There are people that we know who are sincere, non-white, white nationalists, if you will.
Friends of nice white nationalists.
Yeah, they are, just as I am not a tiger, but I am a friend of tigers and want tigers to survive and don't want tigers to go extinct. There are non-whites who don't want white people to go extinct, and we recognize that that's a possibility. We welcome these people. We thank them for their help. There are allies. So that's a definite possibility. And yeah, and I love the other wrinkle to this, which is that most non-whites are ultra-conservative by modern liberal standards. Yeah. And what are they thinking? What are they getting themselves into by opening the borders to this? They haven't thought this through.
If they actually found a black person in the jungles in Africa, they would be surprised to find that that person doesn't have values that would be acceptable to a sociology student in a sort of left-wing campus in America somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, I think they're getting lots of surprises like that now that diversity is happening more and more. And this really is a good point to end on. Again, the main thing that's driving consciousness in our direction is experience of the failures of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. And it's even getting through to people on the left now.
And it's a lethal ideology, because I think at least some listeners will remember, I think it's a year ago now, that one Danish and one Norwegian girl went camping in Morocco.
Yeah.
On the assumption, apparently, that Moroccans will behave just like Norwegians or Danes.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, ripped out of the tent and beheaded.
Yeah.
And as a way to show moral goodness and virtue signal, actually, other young women were encouraged to go on the same trip to show that this is just an exception. This is not, you know, a true danger. Wow. So that's the level of virtue signaling and the level of insanity. So this is an ideology that kills people.
Yeah, it's definitely a deadly ideology.
The system that kills the people, wasn't that an early book of Fi?
That's Fi's first book, yeah. Well, let's wrap it up here. We've been going on for more than an hour. And we are going to do this again. I think this is a good format. I'm experimenting with different formats. Read a particularly ridiculous article and mock it and analyze it. That's a good format. Having interviewers on, doing interviews with interesting people, that's another good format. And a roundtable like this where we answer questions is another good one. So folks, if there are other questions and comments and objections that you think we should discuss, just share it in the comments below this podcast post. Also, scroll down and donate, because we can take donations on a monthly basis again, and also from outside the United States. So that's a positive change. And we thank everybody who's donated in the past, and we would love to have you back on board. And we will be back in 1 week's time with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Take care, everyone.